Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Aaron Day. I'm the soil physicist at North Dakota State University. And today I wanted to talk to you about a new technique that we're trying out. It's a new approach to remediation. So this talk has nothing to do with quantifying or indicating or evaluating or estimating anything, and it has everything to do about effective remediation and timely remediation too. Something that has a chance of hopefully being successful. So the approach that we wanted to take to brine spills is, can we bring salts up out of the ground? That was our main question. This image right here on this first screen is a brine spill in North Dakota. These brine spills originate from produced waters from oil and gas exploration and development. Water is used in the drilling or in the process of opening a well, fracking a well, and when the waters come back out, there's a lot of salts in them, a lot of sodium chloride salts particularly. So these landscapes to where you have spills that will occur anytime you're producing a waste and then it gets transported, it will be spilt at some point in time. When those waters are spilt, we have transformed these soils into being severely saline and sodic, to the point to where it kills all the vegetation and takes them out of any kind of ecological benefit that that soil and that site was giving beforehand, as well as taking it out of any potential for agronomic production from it too. So, just to start off to give you a, kind of an idea, if you're not used to brine spills, of what levels of salts we're actually talking about here. This first slide shows soil samples that we took from brine sites last year, and we published it earlier this year. But I want you to look at the electrical conductivities down here on the x-axis. I've got saturated paste extracts, as well as a 1-to-1 and a 1-to-5 suspension electrical conductivities. And so these dark, these black dots here are the saturated paste. On the edges of brine spills or deep into the soil several feet down, you can find soils that are down in the single digits of electrical conductivities and decisiemens per meter. That's not bad. But these, as you get close to the center and near the surface of these brine spills, electrical conductivities can get up over 100. To put that in perspective, seawater is typically in between 40 and 50. So these are beyond what any plant can really survive. And so it turns them into bare spots out into the landscape. And you can see that they're very well correlated with the amount of sodium in that saturated paste extract, and it's because they're dominated by sodium chloride ions. There is a good bit of calcium in it and a good bit of magnesium, but it is lower levels. These levels in the saturated paste extract typically tend to cluster dominantly in between 10 and 100 millimoles per liter versus our previous screen with the sodium. You can see that there's still an abundance that stretched from the 100 all the way up to approaching 1,000 in there. The brine itself typically has over 100,000 parts per million total dissolved solids and electrical conductivities over 200 themselves. So just to give you an idea of what scale of salinity we're talking about, this is not even remotely close to natural salinity in most landscapes. So, and this happens on a daily occurrence in North Dakota. This is a graph showing from 2001 when the reports to the North Dakota Health Department became more rigorous. They put a lot more details into the actual reports when a spill occurred. And this is the amount of brine spilt in millions of liters since then all the way up to about August of last year. And if you look at this, we've had about over 6,000 spills, and that averages out to just one over a day. Most of these do get contained within on a drill site, on the pad itself. But about 20 to 30, sometimes more than that, given the week or the year, spill over, or a truck tips over, and there is cases of illegal dumping too. So if you figure that out, you can anticipate at least one every week being off the drill pad and on either public land or something like the Forest Service land as well. So how do you take care of it once it's there? Traditionally, the easiest route, or the go-to route, is to excavate it out, the contaminated soil, take it to a permitted landfill, put it there, and bring in some similar material to fill it back in. Well, in the long run, when you have development that's going to persist into the future, and we have a pretty steady record of brine spills, you have to get the replacement material from somewhere, and we are running out of permitted landfills, or they're filling up. There's concerns about bringing on more landfills for it. So excavation is also pricey because of the amount it takes to haul it off site. So no one really likes the excavation, but it does take care of it right then and there. So it's a time convenience. Other places, if you want to remediate them in situ, this is a site, a photo taken by Carmen Waldo from the U.S. Forest Service. This is up around Medora, so getting close to the Theodore Roosevelt National Park area. And in a lot of these cases, we like to try to do some kind of in situ remediation. And the tactic there is to leach the salts below the root zone so you get vegetative cover. Our really only working definition of a remediated site is 70% vegetative cover regained. It has nothing to do with the soil parameters at all in the guidelines, or and there's essentially no regulation with it either. It just has to be attempted to be remediated and get to the 70% vegetative recovery. So in that case, a lot of folks, what they'll do is incorporate some kind of bulking material, straw, manure, to try to get water flow to be maximized. And to deal with the sodium, they'll put down calcium products such as gypsum, because if you leach out your salts but you leave the sodium there, the soil will disperse, and your chance of water actually being able to drain and further leach salts down tends to diminish because all the pores get clogged by dispersed clays. So the calcium is to put down, you're putting down a salt to get rid of the sodium salt, that when that's down, you can finally get rid of everything else. So it's a multiple step process. It's not easy. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to jump forward a few slides after this one, but here's an example of a successful revegetation that Carmen did. This one's a great example. There was a pad, there was a spill, it breached the containment walls, it came down the side. You can see in 2009 here, where the brine spill occurred, they started prepping the site, getting it going, and then by 2013, it's fully revegetated. Now, this looks really nice, but the salts are still down below. And so you have a source that will persist, and if the hydrology ever changes, well, salts like to go wherever the water goes. So, in the long term, it still raises a question, will we see brine spills reappear that have been remediated 30, 40 years from now, or even some other time period later on? It raises the question, because it's not a removal, it's a translocation of the salts. So I'm going to skip forward on a few slides there. That was just on sodium chemistry and hydraulic conductivity things. If you're interested in that complex world of saline sodic soils, feel free to come chat with me afterwards. But what we wanted to do was look at these sites and say, you know, this took several years, many years for this. And that one I showed you previously had been attempted to be remediated for about 50 years now, and repeatedly unsuccessful. These are innately difficult to remediate. So we wanted to ask the question, could we have an actual in-situ remediation strategy that actually removes the salts and kind of works with the natural processes in these environments? With the leaching, we're trying to leach salts in a dry environment that wants to bring the water back up, and salts go where the water goes. So can we take advantage of that? And we asked, could we actually bring salts to the surface, somehow and harvest them that way as a removal? So we looked around the literature on salt effervescence, the ability for salts to crystallize outside of a porous media. If it crystallizes inside the porous media, it's sub-effervescence. And in some of the work over in the early 2000s in Europe, they were looking at how can we preserve historical buildings. Everyone puts out salt on the sidewalk so you don't slip when it ice, right? Well, anyhow, there was concerns about that salt on the sidewalks getting into the stones of these very significant historical thousand-year-old buildings, and then the salts sub-effervescing, building up pressure and degrading the stones from within due to salt precipitation. And they were using this idea of using what's called a crystallization inhibitor, something that actually inhibits salts from precipitating out of solution. It's due to the radius of the molecule and is able to push the supersaturation point up, so it has the solubility limit changes. It stays in suspension instead of precipitating, but life likes to progress and precipitate somewhere if it can, so it shifts and precipitates on nucleation sites outside of the porous media. It's a side effect of it. And we thought, if this could happen in stones, this is happening in a stone brick right here in a lab, could we get this to actually work on soils too? And so we tried a crystallization inhibitor called hexacyanoferrate on soil cores in a lab, and this is a time lapse over a two-day period of where we dose this soil column with a brine solution, with a suspension of the crystallization inhibitor into it, and within hours, the salt started blooming up off the surface. And the salts are very high in water content. There's almost as much water in them as there is salts, solids in it, which makes it soft, easy to just wipe off. And so you can remove salts with essentially no disturbance at all to the soil. So we wanted to explore this further in the lab, check out some items. There's just some snapshots in case the video didn't work that I put on. But you can see the nucleation sites occurring on the surface, and then covering the surface and then growing upwards. And there's no crusting. You wipe these off, and there's no evidence that salt ever precipitated at all inside of that soil. And that crystallization inhibitor is just a very thin film on top. It's not really incorporated in. It's just right at the soil-atmosphere interface. And a little bit closer photo of what some of these effervescence looks like a little bit up close in comparison to a core that had no inhibitor at all and it just crusted. So we tested in the laboratory looking at a few different soils, different molar concentrations, and different ways of applying it to say, all right, we saw that it happened, but now how do you even start to bring something like this to the field? And we tested all these different things, different soils, different molar concentrations, and our highest concentrations we used when we applied the inhibitor to the surface, either on soils that had already been crusted, or we're still actively infiltrating a brine. Either way, we got the same results on those two. We could extract anywhere from 30 to just shy of 60% of all the salts within 7 days. And that's the big item there, is it's fast, and it is a removal. When we incorporated the inhibitor, mixed it in, like disking, tillage, something like that, it actually shut the process completely off, which is a good thing. It dilutes it down into the soil to where it shuts off the mechanism, because that's not where the salts are trying to precipitate at. They're trying to go to the soil surface and precipitate. And if you use this for remediation, you don't want it to repeatedly effervesce anything else in life. Most nutrients are a form of salt. So a shut-off mechanism, such as just simply disking it, is convenient. And then the ultimate test, taking it to the field. We took it to the field this summer. This is brand new stuff. We applied down this particular inhibitor to this big, massive site. It's blue in color, as you can tell, the inhibitor itself. And then we could start seeing evidence of salts come to the surface. We saw effervescence starting to occur, and then it fizzled out. So it's difficult going from the lab to the field, but we learned a few things here. In the lab, we had optimum water supply to bring salts to the surface. In the field, you're not always guaranteed that, and we think that we probably had a deficit of water to continuously supply salts up to the surface effectively by water, because if water's not bringing salts up, the process is going to stop. There's no influx of salts to the effervescence. The other thing, too, that we went back to the lab and we found out, we started narrowing the range in between sodium and calcium. So something like a site that's been attempted to be remediated before by putting calcium on it. And we found that once you get so high in calcium, it shuts down the effervescence process, too. Likelihood because these soils do have some sulfates in them, and calcium, magnesium sulfates precipitate out of solution at much, much lower concentrations than sodium chloride does. So if you have something that can start crusting and shut down the effervescence process, it will. And we saw that in the lab. So we've learned a few things. Next year in the spring, we're working with some companies to do some actual live spills when they happen, because they're common. They do happen. So we know that we will have some opportunities to try these on spills that happen the same day. And hopefully we'll see how this goes along. In the long run, I'd actually like to see this material not applied directly to the soil. I'd like to see engineered mats made out of it so it can be reused, cost effective, and you're not mending the soil with some product, you know, that's traditionally never been used to mend the soil with. So, I don't know if I went over or not, but
a little bit, but
all right.